Blog Talk Radio.
Everybody, and welcome to another edition of Crime and Science Radio, of course, hosted by Doug Lyle and Jan Burke. Today's show is called Men of Valor, an interview with author and weapons expert John F. Mullins, who is a retired major in the U.S. Army Special Forces. Sure to be a winner on this one. Mullins joined the U.S. Army in 1960 and had three tours in Vietnam with the Special Forces, so you're going to get an inside look into the behind the scenes here of exactly how these operations and these things are run. Of course, is a big topic today, military political thrillers, everything that's going on in the news, that this is like perfect timing to be able to have Mr. Mullins here on the show. And of course, all of our shows here on Suspense Radio are brought to you by Kensington Books. You go to kensingtonbooks.com or kensingtonpublishing.com for more information. And also check out darkrenaissancebooks.com for more information on all the stuff that they are going on and that they have publishing. So, again, this is the last Crime and Science Radio of 2015. Everybody will be back in January. So look at the schedule. Check that out. Just join the podcast on iTunes so you will be up to date on everything. And when a new show airs, you'll get it right downloaded to you and listen to it however you do. So, Doug and Jan, take it away.
Well, welcome, everyone, to another episode of Crime and Science Radio. We are glad to be back with you today with a wonderful interviewee. We're so excited to have John F. Mullins with us, who is a retired major of Special Forces, served three tours in Vietnam, multiple honors for his service, and we will get into talking to him about that, about his work in security and everything he's been doing since. He's also known to many of you as a character who basically based really on himself, had an avatar long before any of the rest of us did, in Soldier of Fortune. So gamers will know him from that. He's also an author, and we will also be talking with him about his newest book. So, John, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Great to have you here. Well, as I was just sort of briefly alluding to there, you have one of the most amazing histories of anyone I know. We could do a whole show just reading off your resume, I believe, and even then we have to just hit every third major point, I think. So for us, we'll gain even less than that and try and get an overview. So start out, tell us about where you grew up and how you ended up in the military.
I grew up right here in Southwest Oklahoma, actually on the farm I'm living on now. This is a farm that was opened up when the Kiowa Comanche Apache Reservation opened up, and our grandparents saw this. So we've been here a little over 100 years, although I haven't been there all that time. I graduated from high school in a little town here at 17 years old. And not having a whole lot of prospects out here, I decided that I would join the military. Everything went from that.
So tell us a little bit about that. What was your military career? What phases did it go through? What was the progression there?
Well, I started off, we had hired a hand out here who had been in the 101st Airborne during World War II, and he told me all these stories about jumping out of airplanes, and I thought that sounded like wonderful fun. So I joined up Airborne unassigned. I went to jump school, became a paratrooper, was assigned to the 101st Airborne for a short time. But then this guy came around and he had this green beret on and he had a uniform full of medals and he looked really good and he was asking for volunteers for something called the Special Forces. I had no clue what Special Forces was, but I did want to continue on at that point, so I volunteered, took all the tests. They sent me to Fort Bragg, and at that point, they asked me what I wanted to be. We have 5 specialties in any Special Forces agency. We have the operations and intelligence people, the weapons people, the demolitions people, the communications people, and the medics. I was at that point 18 years old, and they told me that if I became a medic, I would go to Fort Sam Houston, where there were lots of female soldiers. that pretty much convinced me I wanted to be a medic.
is that like that marching song that ends with a line about my recruiter fooled me too?
I met this young medic down there, and she and I started getting along pretty well, so we decided to get married, and 53 long years later, we're still together.
That's great. That's great. Well, you know, most people don't have any idea of what the Special Forces do if they think of them in connection with the Vietnam War, that Green Berets makes them think of a song or a John Wayne movie. So to the extent, you know, you can talk about it, what kind of people became part of your unit and what did that unit do?
Well, the first thing, it was in the recruitment and selection process. You had to have what we call the GT score in those days, which was a general knowledge score, sort of like an IQ test. You had to have a high score in that. You had to be physically fit, and, of course, you had to be very, very motivated because it was a lot and very hard, very tough training. We started out in the medic school with 40 people, and we graduated 12.
Mm.
It was extremely intense, but as a medic, we were qualified in those days to do everything from appendectomies, childbirth, amputations, treat combat wounds, and treat every disease known to man with nothing more than a manual and a little bit of knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
The mission of Special Forces actually is force multiplier. People think of the Green Berets as this commando outfit. We were not. We could do commando missions. We could do the raids, ambushes, so forth. But that was just part of what we did. What our mission was and what we'd been organized for in the first place was if the balloon went up and the Warsaw Pact started moving through Europe, we were to drop behind enemy lines, recruit, organize, equip, and train and lead into combat indigenous forces, guerrillas, against the rear areas of the Warsaw Pact nations. From that, it grew into, when we got into Vietnam, it was similar in that we did the same thing with the indigenous tribes there, the Montagnards, the Cambodians, the Hmong, and Laos. We would go out and recruit these guys, we'd train them up, we'd give them all the training they need, and then we'd conduct combat operations. At one point, we had the largest, we actually had more people under just 83 Special Forces teams than the entire American contingent of the war.
Hmm. I don't think many people realize that.
No. I don't think people realize a lot of things.
I really don't. I mean, I do think you're right. I think people think of it strictly as the commando type of thing. They don't realize what you guys are really mainly about.
We're primarily trainers. And that is something that that people don't understand. We, a Special Forces A team, there's 12 people out there. Frankly, you couldn't fight off a platoon of Boy Scouts if they were really determined Boy Scouts. So we certainly we recruited these people, and they had been oppressed by their current government. They didn't like the North Vietnamese at all. They didn't like Vietnamese at all, but North Vietnamese especially. So they weren't hard to recruit, and they were extremely good soldiers in the field. They knew the terrain, they knew how to live off the land, and while we trained them, we also learned a great deal from them.
So how long did you remain in the military?
I served for 22 years.
Well,
I did my first tour of Vietnam as a medic in on the Cambodian border in an A-team there. Did some fighting there, but there was 1963. It wasn't as intense as later on became. Came back to the States. They sent me to French language school. They like all Special Forces people to be language qualified in at least one or two different languages besides profanity.
Which came natural in the military.
Then they decided in their infinite wisdom I should have a commission. I became that worst of all things according to my team sergeants. Damn same lieutenant. Went off to Ranger School, and then back to Vietnam, this time in 1966-67 in the Central Highlands. The war was far more intense at that point. Was awarded my first Silver Star and a Purple Heart to go with it for that tour. Came back to the States and spent a little bit of time doing some training. We were doing a lot of training for the soldiers over there. Most of the encounters that happened there were very close range, so there wasn't a lot of time to really take a good sight picture and so forth. So we came up with a program called Quick Kill, which was instinctive shooting. We went around and taught that to all the people who were being deployed into Vietnam in the 67, 68 time frame. After a while, I got tired of that and decided I had to go back and do a little bit more of the war. So in 1968, I volunteered to go back, and I went to an outfit called MACB Studies and Observations Group. Nice, innocuous name, which essentially our job was to take reconnaissance units over across the border in Laos, Cambodia, and before the bombing halt in 68 in the North Vietnam. And, of course, we weren't there, you understand. But, amazed me sometimes because I thought we were. maybe my map reading skills were not quite as good as I thought. Was awarded the second Silver Star while I was with SOG, and then extended my tour because, quite frankly, I got tired of killing snuffies. Some poor guy who comes out, who gets yanked out of a rice paddy in North Vietnam, given a little modicum of training, sent off down south to fight, and didn't last very long. So I volunteered for a program that started taking care of the people who sent out those people. It's called the Phoenix Program, and the mission was neutralization of the Viet Cong infrastructure. There was a lot of controversy over it, but it was when Bo Nguyen Giap, after the war, said, what two things did he fear most about what we did? He said, B-52s and the Phoenix Program. Mm.
You mentioned some term there. I want you to kind of tell a little bit more about it. Instinctive shooting. What is that? How would you define it?
I'm sorry, say again.
You said you mentioned instinctive shooting.
Instinctive shooting.
Yeah. Connors, why don't you tell our listeners what that means and how that
It came from a competitive shotgun shooter. He was world class on skeet and trap and so forth. And of course, on with the shotgun shooting in that time, you never use the sights. Essentially, you build muscle memory. And where you point is where after you get used to it after a time, is where that bullet is going to go, where that shot is going to go. We'd start off with aerial shooting. We'd take BB guns. Daisy loved this, by the way, because we bought thousands and thousands of BB guns. We'd use an aluminum disc thrown into the air, and we'd take all the sights off of these things. So it was strictly a feedback type thing. They'd start hitting that aluminum disc. They'd get that satisfying ping. We'd take it on down to a much smaller aluminum disc, about the size of a half dollar, and start hitting that regularly. Then we'd get silly about it. We'd start shooting at dimes and nickels and aspirin tablets and so forth. But it built a tremendous sense of confidence in these guys, and they were able then to not sit there and try to get a good sight picture and so forth that everybody talks about. They were able to engage targets much, much quicker than they would have been otherwise.
I know exactly.
Is that good for long distances? No, of course not.
No.
But at the combat ranges that we were doing there, anywhere from 5 feet to 25 yards, it was very, very effective.
Well, I grew up in Alabama, and I had several Daisy Geeky guns. And I know exactly what you're talking about. I could terrorize the neighborhood birds with it. And, of course, my dad and I, growing up in Alabama, we dove hunted every fall. And dove hunting is exactly what you say. You don't aim. You point and shoot, and you keep both eyes open, and you try.
Yep.
I mean, it's as simple as that. And so that's instinctive shooting. But let me ask you this. What do you wish, as someone who actually, you know, went to college and grew up during that era, because I'm an old guy, and a lot of the listeners are too young really to remember Vietnam, what do you wish people really understood about that conflict and about the vets that gave their life blood, sweat, and tears and PTSD and everything for that conflict? What do you wish people really understood?
Well, what I wish they understood was that it was a product of the times. I was there when Kennedy, a young man in the army, when Kennedy said we would fight any foe, bear any burden, fight any foe in the cause of freedom, and that's exactly what we were doing. The North Vietnamese were a communist nation. We were anti-communist, very much so, because at that time we were very much afraid that communism was going to be, as Khrushchev had said, it was going to bury us. So we, rather than fight the big war, we fought the peripheral wars. And that goes from Korea through Vietnam, and still, really today, we're still fighting these peripheral wars. Should we have gone into Vietnam? That was way beyond my pay grade. I don't know. What I do know is that it bought time for the rest of the countries in that area. Thailand, people don't realize that Thailand had an extremely threatening movement up in the north of Thailand. They were very much afraid that they were going to be the next Vietnam. Laos, of course, fell. Cambodia fell. Indonesia was going the same way, and as you probably know, that's the largest Muslim nation in the world. They probably would have had the same, and they did have a problem. Malaya, the British had been fighting there and with the Malayans for quite some time. So it was the policy at the time. The business about that, I guess I have to say, the contempt that ended up with, that we had to face when we came back because of the anti-war movement and all the media and talking about the atrocities and so forth and so on. It was tough times in the 70s.
Well,
I never did. I'm wearing a uniform. I never did get anybody try to spit on me. I don't know why.
Must have been something in the look in your eye. I would.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm glad you didn't have that particular fit, although I'm sorry that you had to wait a long time for. I think people eventually did, a lot of people anyway, not everybody, but a lot of people woke up and said, you know, the disgrace was how those guys were treated.
Yeah, no doubt about it.
Yeah. Well, I'm trying to figure out a way I can ask you to tell us about a couple of adventures from your very, very adventurous life without getting you into trouble or, you know, breaking any promises or agreements that you had to make to partake them. But so are there any stories that you would just care to share as an example? And as I mentioned to you earlier, I want to make sure that this isn't something that will get Charlie to cross me after Christmas card.
Finally decided to retire from the military because it looked like we were going to be facing a peacetime. We were talking about the mid-80s on through, and things had really died down a lot. And I found along the way that I was a far better soldier when we were in a war than I was when we were sitting around in garrison, because I got terribly bored. So when I retired, I went to work for Department of Defense over in the Middle East. Worked there for about 3 years, training a special battalion for the protection of the Saudi royal family and for counterinsurgency missions. Then decided, well, you know, I'm getting a little old. Probably ought to think about another career. Came back to the States. Went back to college, got an MBA, and found out fairly quickly that corporate America didn't have a lot of my use for my peculiar skills.
Mm-hmm.
So I went to started doing missions for various government agencies. I think I've worked for every government agency at one time or another except HUD, although they probably needed me from the way I was. Went off for the State Department Anti-Terrorism Assistance Program. This was after the planes were hijacked by the Palestinian terrorists and taken into the Jordanian desert and blown up. We finally came around to understanding maybe we are security on our aviation assets ought to be a little bit better. So we trained officials from about 83 different countries on anti-terrorism, how to spot terrorists, how to counter terrorism. Did that for a couple of years. Went off places like Bolivia, Guatemala, El Salvador, you know, the fun places. Went and did quite a bit of work in West Africa, also did a lot more work in the Middle East. They're calling it Southwest Asia now, I guess. Went at one point, got involved with the drug wars because the judges in Colombia were getting killed on a rate of about one a week. Because they had agreed at that point to extradite the people that they had captured, the cartel people up in the United States for prosecution. So Pablo Escobar and his help didn't like that very much, so they were killing these people. So they asked me to put together a team, go down there and protect the judges, and to train the judicial police for continuing protection. That was interesting times. We changed hotels about every 3 days, and about every fourth day they blew up the hotel that we'd been in.
Mm.
After a time, it got to where we couldn't get a hotel anywhere in Boca.
I couldn't imagine why.
It's kind of realizing it is something of a miracle that you're here to tell us about all of
this. Yeah, my Marriott reward wasn't working too well in those days.
You're also recognizable to about a zillion gamers, one of the biggest games ever. So tell us about how your time with Soldier of Fortune came about.
Well, I have a producer friend out. I'd written a book that it's been in development now for 25 years, I guess, which is a short time for Hollywood. Mm-hmm. He had optioned the book way back when. We're talking early 90s now, and we became friends. And later on, he was producing a television show called Soldier of Fortune. It went on for about 2 seasons. He asked me if I wanted to write a couple of scripts for it. I said, sure. Am I going to get paid for it? He said, yes. And I said, well, obviously, I'm a mercenary, so
yeah.
All right. Did that. They got produced. And then a short time later, he called up and said they were going to make a video game out of it. They need somebody to consult on the video game to get things right. Would you be amenable to that? Am I going to get paid for it? Yes. Okay. I have a fairly standard answer for that kind of thing. So I went off to Madison, Wisconsin, to Raven Software, and walked into this building, and it was almost like a hallway that was broken up into 20 or 30 cubicles. And inside those cubicles was the unhealthy green glow coming from the CRT screens at the time. The kids in there with trash cans full of empty Mountain Dew bottles and Twinkie wrappers. Every Star Wars figure that had ever come out in their original packaging lining the walls of these things, and they're in there doing magic on these computers. So I gave them some tips, and we went through some drills there to help them figure out what actually was real and what wasn't. Shortly thereafter, I get another call, and they said, we know your background. We think we'd like to have you as the main character in Soldier of Fortune. And I gave my usual, do I get paid? So after that, I proceeded. Game went through 2 iterations before it fell apart and contract issues and ownership and so forth. But at that point, I guess it was probably the most popular first-person shooter that they'd had at that point. So I got killed by about a couple million teenage boys. They had a big fan club, but you know, my groupies weren't exactly the ones that I would have, like a rock star, I'm afraid.
They weren't like the women being offered it for too.
I didn't get a single pair of panties thrown at me.
Although I can attest, I think we watched your E3 together, that you certainly did have. You did have fans that recognized you. I was with the Beatles that day. But anyway, we're going to take a short break, and we will be right back to talk more with our fascinating guest, John F. Mullen. Welcome back, everyone. We're talking to John F. Mullen, who has had exciting is hardly the word to say in connection with his life. He is also a weapons expert and can offer many other tips to our lighter listeners and those of you who are just curious about the realities of that. We'll get into all of that. Welcome back.
Yeah, welcome back, John.
Thank you.
You were talking before the break about Soldier Fortune and the gamer world and all that, but you've been involved in other things since you left the military, too. Why don't you tell us a little bit about what else has gone on in your life, since I'm sure it's so boring from what I...
Well, there have been boring times, not too long in history, but yeah, there have been. Staying in my field of expertise, I did quite a few things. One was to, when we were doing our training for hostage rescue back in the early days when Delta was first formed and Blue Light, we didn't have very good training facilities to do that, and that was largely because you go into a regular building and you're shooting regular ammunition. You got a real problem of shoot-through, ricochet, and splashback. So we went through all sorts of iterations, Michelin tire cities, tires filled with sand, railroad tie houses out in the Saudi desert. We built an entire city out of target cloth and 2x4s. Needless to say, we shot through that, killed a couple of camels, did not make ourselves popular. So I thought, if there are two problems that you have in building a shoot house, which I built one at Fort Bragg. It was cost $7 million. It was so small, it was like having a shoot out in your closet. So I thought, if we can't change the training facilities, why don't we change the bullet? So I came up with a bullet that would not ricochet under any circumstances. Once it hit a hard target, it would disintegrate into particles so small that it effectively doesn't exist anymore, and that you could use for tactical training. Like most entrepreneurs, after getting a product that was woefully underfunded, produced that bullet under the name of Longbow for several years. But when a Swiss company decided that they wanted to buy my rights, I was more than happy to sell them to them. This was also about the time that of 9/11. I had been in Macedonia. I had some friends there that one of the government agencies wanted me to go over and talk to them about some of the problems they were having. I got back down into Athens and saw the entire thing being played out on the screens there, and TV made it as far as anyone, but I took refuge with one of my old MI6 friends and couldn't go anywhere. Of course, all the air travel was suspended at that point. Going a little bit crazy, but that night I get a call from an old employer that said, you've got to come back to work. So for the next 10 years, I worked security and security operations in the field of aviation. Traveled to all the fun places again, the stands, Uzbekistan, various other stands, Bulgaria, West Africa, South America, South and Central America, upgrading the security of these facilities, both for the airlines and the airfields themselves. So that kept me pretty well occupied up until basically almost the end of the 2000s. At the end of 2010, I should say. Then the same Swiss company that had my rights asked me to come back on board because of people I seem to have some reputation in the firearms field, and to help them market their products throughout the United States.
Well, that's going to be my next question, is your expertise in weaponry. But tell us a little bit about that, how that came about, and what you do. And then also, as a writer, how do you see writers using this information, right and wrong, in different?
But my expertise came from experience. Of course, we in the airborne. I was a machine gunner in the airborne, carrying an old 1986 machine gun. That was because I was tall and I was the only one around that could jump the gun. in the Special Forces, of course, we cross-trained on every weapon that we might find in the field. And that certainly wasn't just American weapons. That was French, German, Japanese, anything that you can imagine. In fact, our first tour over there was we had this huge dump of arms and ammunition that had gotten, the CIA had gotten from Inter Arms Co., the old Sam Cummings outfit, and we had everything from German MG-42s down to Thompson submachine gun. Well, you can imagine with all the different ammunition for all those things, trying to outfit a company to go into the field was a nightmare in logistics. But certainly you got to know all those weapons very intimately. Not only their usage, tactical usage, but how to repair them, how to take them down, how to reassemble them, so forth. So that just continued on throughout the 22 years I was in the Army. And then my work has continued partially with weapons for ever since. So it's a pretty intimate familiarity. As far as your question about how do authors use this, some of them do it very well. But most of them who do it have somebody who is advising them. I noticed that one of the big authors now cites one of my good friends as one of his advisors in the weapons, and he usually gets it very right. Some of the things that you see, you still will people will do, and it's not just writers, not writers per se, I mean script writers and the people in the movie industry. One of them is you see somebody being shot and it'll just throw them up against a wall and they'll flail their arms and everything else. This knockdown power. It amuses me because I'm fairly familiar with Newtonian physics. For each action, there is an equal and opposite reaction. So if you got something that will knock somebody else down, it's going to knock you down firing it. The idea, and again, writing in newspapers and television shows and everything else, why did they have to shoot the guy 5, 6, 10, 15 times, you have to shoot until the threat is gone. People think that you can shoot somebody in the middle of the chest and the fight's over, he's going to go down, and that's the end of it. The FBI shootout should have proved that stupid thing. These guys finally bled out, but they had killed 3 FBI agents in the meantime after they had first been shot.
Exactly.
I've known people who lived for quite some extended period of time and were still in the fight and finally died simply from bleeding out. Only two ways to stop somebody, and that is brainstem hit, that's immediate, or a bleed out. And if you have to shoot somebody 10, 15 times, well, that's what you do.
As a physician, I can tell you if they're drunk, they'll make it to the ER alive with 15 bullets in them. Yeah, but you can't kill a drunk with a gun.
I believe that's true.
And apparently not with a car either. It's usually the family that gets wiped out, but not the drunk.
Well, one of the things that I learned from talking to you was that when I was writing about a character with a weapon, I needed to think about the character when I chose his or her weapon. So can you give some examples of the factors that writers should consider when they're matching up their character with the weaponry?
Yeah, it goes back to what is suitable for the person. One of the things that I do in training, when I'm training people for concealed carry in the training program that I put together, is that I give them a series of weapons to shoot. Because I'm a firm believer that unless the weapon feels right to you and just is that undefinable thing, yes, I can shoot this thing properly, you'll never shoot it properly. Some weapons are too big for some people. People think about, well, a 45. God, yes, that 45 is a great bullet, and it is. It's a lot of weight that you're putting into a target. Problem is that is a fat bullet also. So the people don't think about the fact that that has to fit into a magazine, which then has to fit into the magazine well of your pistol. So for a person of small stature, small hands, they're probably not going to shoot it well, especially if they try to get a 45 that's a double-stack magazine. Their hands just don't fit it. So you have to pick a weapon that you're comfortable with and that you feel that you can shoot properly and doesn't have so much recoil that you get a built-in flinch from the first time that you shoot it. Some weapons recoil, obviously, much worse than others. A large part of it is dependent upon not only the bullet that's being shot, but what the weight of the weapon itself. A very lightweight weapon, you're going to feel more recoil. Doesn't matter what you shoot. There's a little 380 that's quite common out there now that a lot of people are using. It is miserable to shoot, and 380 is basically a rabbit killer. But the gun is just not designed where it is. It's a fun gun to shoot, and if you don't shoot it and you don't practice with it, you're never going to be good at it.
Well, let me ask you, for writers out there, what kind of resources or what's the best way that they can learn about weapons for their stories? What's the best way?
Find somebody that actually knows what they're talking about, rather than some old bubba who, come here, little girl, and I'll teach you how to shoot. has some of the worst ideas in the world. Find somebody who is a legitimate trainer, and they'll lead you down the right way. They can give you the information that you need as far as your character, what should be used, what might be available, depending on where you are. If you're going off to a foreign country and you're down in Italy and you're trying to acquire a weapon somewhere, you're probably not going to find too many Colt 45s. So it really depends on circumstances, depends on the plot, depends on whether or not it is something you pick up or something you carry. I've seen things where they talk about carrying a Desert Eagle 50. Well, my God. That thing is concealable only if you probably weigh about 300 pounds and you've got this coat that is about four sizes too large for you at that point.
You're concealed cannon at that point, right? Concealed
cannon, that's it. Exactly.
Well, not all weapons.
Unless you hit something vital, it really doesn't matter.
Exactly. Well, not all weapons are guns. What are other weapons that riders should
use? Actually, I do a lot of non-lethal training. Pepper spray, impact weapons, tasers, and so forth. But what my family carries and what I have in my pickup readily at hand at any given time is a can of wasp spray.
Interesting.
That's directional. You can shoot it 20, 30 feet. And I assure you, you put a good squirt of that in somebody's eyes, you're going to have plenty of time to get away. And that's the issue. If it is a perfectly good shoot, there's no question that you were in fear for your life or fear for somebody else's life, and you put somebody down, it's going to be a hassle. you are going to have police investigations. You're going to have people crawling up your behind from the media, and it is, having been there, it's a miserable experience. With something non-lethal, then it is give them a shot in the eye and drive away.
Well, I was wondering if you could talk to us. I want to make sure we have time to talk about your books here, but maybe just talk quickly. You train people in law enforcement and security. What are some of the things that the average bear out there who may or may, you know, they may not consider these things when they're buying a gun for protection in the whole area of training? What are some things people need to keep in mind if they are thinking about gun ownership?
What they need to keep in mind is that the aforementioned muscle memory. The people will go through these concealed carry classes. It is a day long. Basically, they get the legal aspects of it. They go to the range. They shoot at a paper target and put the gun away. And except for occasionally going to the range and shooting a paper target, that's the last they see of it. You have to have the ability to react essentially without thinking. If you're thinking, you are behind you're outside the OODA loop, as they say it. You've got to be inside that loop. And that is the ability to react before somebody can make a conscious decision to act against you. And the only way to do that is pure muscle memory. And that goes from not just the shooting by any means. Goes weapons presentation. Where are you going to carry that thing? I assure you that some of these guns that are out there, and they're lovely guns, they're accurate, they're also, having carried a weapon for a lot of years, at the end of the day, it's like you're carrying a brick. You really get tired of carrying it. So then you put it in the glove compartment, or you put it in between the seats or something else, and you've never practiced getting it out of there and presenting it. You are behind the loop. So you have to, I've told people that if you're, do your training as you would look at a scenario. All right, you're on the street. You have to pull your weapon because somebody is threatening you with a knife. You need to get that weapon out. First thing that you have to do is look for cover. Get as far away from that person. Back up if you need to. Turn around because if somebody's within 20 feet of you, by the time you get that weapon out of its holster and present it and fire, they'll be on top of you, stabbing you in the kidney. So you can't just depend on, I got a gun, I'm safe. By no means are you safe. You're in a car. You got the seatbelt on. You're carrying your weapon, as most people do, in a hip holster. That's interfering with the seatbelt. You try grabbing that weapon, especially if you have some clothing on over that weapon, which you should have, obviously, for concealed carry. And most people don't think to take their shirt or their coat and pull it out from beneath that seatbelt and make sure that that weapon is easily accessible. It's not being constricted by that seatbelt in the car. Fumbling is not the place to have when you're in a life or death situation. You need to think about where you're going to carry that weapon. Are you going to be wearing it? Are you going to be putting it into a man purse, as I did in Colombia? Are you going to be putting it into a woman purse, as lots of females do? And it's not a good solution. I can tell you because you get a semi-automatic, and it's stuck down into a purse somewhere with all the chewing gum wrappers and pieces of lipstick and all the rest of it that tends to accumulate in a woman's purse. You might get the first round off, but after that, it's probably going to jam. So all these things are considerations when you are when you're doing this, and that's why you need to get a trainer who actually knows what the hell they're talking about.
Well, for writers who want to write about veterans, their stories, the good, the bad, and the ugly, et cetera, what are some of the things that they should keep in mind and some of the, you know, numerous cliches we hear, how to avoid them?
Well, the assumption is that all veterans are disturbed in one way or another, and that's probably at least partially true. You can't go into a life-or-death situation and take the life of another human being or watch your friends die and it not change you. It does. But the other thing that you need to look at is that all veterans have not been in combat. The average in Vietnam, the logistics tail to the fighters staying out there was a 10-to-1 ratio. You had guys that would go through the entire tour in Vietnam and never hear a shot fired in anger, but would come back and claim how disturbed they were because of this or that and so forth and so on. So know who you're talking to in the first place. You get a lot of bullshitters out there, frankly, that, I was in the NOM, I was this, I was that, they're very easy to pick out, especially if you have some experience in that area. Some guy in the 47th mess kit repair company probably did not do a lot of work for him.
Well, I want to make sure that we hear about your book, so let's talk about those for a little bit. Talk about your books and how people can order them, so we're sure to get that in, because one thing I really, I'm know by now, anyone who's listened to this program will want to know where they can read your writing. So tell us about that.
The first ones I wrote were Vietnam War novels. I call it the Men of Valor series. It takes two individuals. I sort of based it on the idea of Once an Eagle, taking two individuals that interact over the years and how things turn out for them. The first one was called Napalm Dream. Second one was Into the Tree Line. Third one was Bayonet Skies. I dream up these titles, and then I have to write a book to go with them. take two special operations guys and a third peripheral character and bring them through three tours in Vietnam. And then it would have gone on to continue on to where they come almost to the present day with all the things that happened thereafter. The pocketbooks decided after fairly dismal sales that they didn't want to continue on with the series, so now they're available as e-books through Amazon and through Simon & Schuster, I guess. The second series is what I call my Apache County series. That takes the idea of an old special operations guy who has been bouncing around the world for a very long time, and now he's decided he's had enough of it. He goes back to the old family farm in southwest Oklahoma, where someone talks him into becoming the county sheriff. I sort of know people like that. So far, that's three books, working on the fourth one now. They take terrain features of southwest Oklahoma as their titles, Owl Creek, North Fork, and Devil's Canyon. Another one that's available is a book I wrote after the first Gulf War called Camsoon. Again, special operations guy. And then there's one called The Fatal Five, which will be coming out shortly. It's another one-off book. The idea there is you got five people who have life-threatening situations, so they become sacrificial lambs for missions that nobody else will take.
Well, I just want to tell everybody, having read John's, I'm looking forward to a couple of them that I haven't read yet, but of the ones that I have read, you'll love them. They're intense. They're full of true insider knowledge. They don't get any more realistic, and they're also suspenseful, high-energy stuff. So I do hope our listeners will follow through the links on our website at crimeandscienceradio.com and check out these books. John, thank you so much for spending time with us today. I'm hoping one day we can have you back, because I know there are about 2 dozen more questions.
Exactly.
And I would love to talk to you about things. We had to get through, you know, everything we wanted to talk about today, but we really appreciate the time, and thank you again for all you've done for, you know, not just people here in this country, but throughout the world. So it's been so great to talk to you, and an honor to call you my friend.
I appreciate that, Jen, and you have been a very true friend all this time, and I appreciate it.
Well, until next time, we'll do it again.